From Washington, this is the CQ Budget Podcast, your leading Capitol Hill source on how Congress allocates federal taxpayer dollars. And welcome back to the CQ Budget Podcast. I'm David Lerman, your budget tracker. And Congress this week is finally on the verge of clearing for the president's signature a $95 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The big logjam was broken Saturday after months of stalemate when Speaker Mike Johnson finally agreed to take up the package after breaking it up into four separate bills with some key tweaks from the measure that the Senate had passed in February. But a slim majority of House Republicans voted against this Ukraine aid, despite Johnson's best efforts to unite most of his party around the measure. And his job is now on the line as he faces an ouster threat from three GOP lawmakers led by Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene. So we want to talk about what the vote says about the shifting politics toward foreign aid in the Republican Party of Donald Trump, what this package could mean for Ukraine's survival, and more. And joining me for that conversation is John Donnelly, a senior defense writer at CQ Roll Call. Thanks for being here, John.
Great to be with you.
So you and I were both at the Capitol Saturday for some pretty extraordinary votes on this long-stalled aid package, which capped months of internal GOP wrangling over how to handle Ukraine aid. And in the end, the embattled House Speaker did manage to get the package over the finish line, but he suffered a fresh round of slings and arrows in the process. So, John, what should we make of this outcome? How did we get here? You know, President Biden asked for this aid about 6 months ago now. They're pretty late. What strikes you the most out of this whole saga?
First and foremost, stepping outside Washington for a quick second, the most important thing is that Ukraine's going to get some weapons that is going to help it survive. And the signal that this vote sends to the Ukrainian forces, to Russia, to our European allies who we're looking to see, is America in or out on this? So I think, you know, the biggest thing is what the real world effect will be on the battlefield. But in Washington, it's been truly, you use the word extraordinary, and I think that's perfect, a perfect word. You had Republicans wrangling with themselves and with Democrats over whether and how to provide this money for a half a year. And, you know, to me, this is an illustration of how individual human beings are what drives history. And while Speaker Mike Johnson didn't do this alone, he was really the pivotal figure here. And his evolution from somebody who got an F in 2023 from a group called Republicans for Ukraine to a sort of non-committal stance, and then just this week to a full-throated Reagan-esque defense of U.S. engagement abroad, that has been incredible to watch. And his decision to, you know, to push for this aid is really what made it happen. Republicans for months wanted to try to include some kind of immigration-related overhaul, and that fell flat. There was a vote on that in the House this week, but it was really just for show. On Saturday, and it was really just for show. So, you know, this is just incredible how this transpired. And also, think about it. You've got a Republican Speaker of the House who ended up supporting a Democratic president's policy on the strength, really, of Democratic votes.
Which is why his job is now at some risk.
Well, perhaps. You may even think that his job is at less risk after this vote. Because, you know, some Democrats have already signaled that they will support Johnson if there is an effort by Marjorie Taylor Greene and company to try to oust him in a so-called motion to vacate. But, you know, there may be even more Democrats willing to support him after Saturday. And, you know, it's only going to take a few to keep him in office. So his position within the GOP conference is pretty tenuous, but only at, you know, but I don't know if he's literally going to be kicked out of office because of that. But there's major internal GOP strife as we speak on Twitter over who's to blame for, you know, from the point of view of the hard right group, who's to blame for the Ukraine vote. And of course, it was a package of, for as you said, for Ukraine, Israel, Indo-Pacific. But the Ukraine stuff was really the most contentious.
Right. And it was the Ukraine aid that, that had held this up all along, really. I mean, the House had already passed on its own Israel aid. You know, they were willing to do that in a heartbeat. It was Ukraine always that was the sticking point here. And it was striking to me, John. I mean, I was in the House chamber when the vote was being cast. And you had this extraordinary moment on the House floor where, as the Ukraine aid was passing, all of the Democrats suddenly stood up and waved Ukrainian flags on the House floor, cheering this. And you saw all the Republicans just sitting in their seats pretty much stone-faced, right? Clearly dreading this moment. And feeling very uncomfortable. And it really spoke to where the parties are now. I mean, when you think about the party of Ronald Reagan, who called the Soviet Union the evil empire, it was always Republicans who were the most gung-ho on foreign policy, interventionist, let's beat back the Russians. And it just feels like the, you know, and Democrats were accused of being the peacenik party, right? You know, coming from out of Vietnam. And it feels like the politics of it has been flipped on their heads on both parties, whereas now it's Democrats leading the charge to beat back Russia, Russian aggression in Europe. And Republicans are clearly divided. And we should say It was pretty evenly divided. I think among Republicans, it was 101 in favor of Ukraine, 112 against.
Right.
So a majority went against, as I say, despite Johnson's best efforts here. But, I mean, that's a pretty stunning political reversal for the parties, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But we've been watching it develop over several years now. But it's no less remarkable for that. The fact that the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan has increasingly become isolationist and populist. And, but, you know, we've seen these cycles in American history where we become more nativist and isolationist and then it swings back. But yeah, it's been really unbelievable. And, you know, the polls show that the Republicans out in the country are even more opposed to helping Ukraine in particular, especially with economic aid, than even the GOP House members. It's hard not to think that a lot of that is being driven by disinformation, you know, and a lot of the right-wing infosphere, you know, stories, for example, about Ukrainian President Zelensky spending foreign aid money on yachts and things like that, completely false, you know, reports, but they get circulation and literally members of Congress are believing some of this stuff.
Well, now, in fairness, you know, we should say that the critics here had some real concerns that they were expressing too. I mean, opponents did say that first of all, they were worried about some corruption concerns. They were also making the case that Europe needs to carry more of the weight, you know, that we were doing too much, and that they didn't see an end game to this war. And so how much more money should American taxpayers be asked to spend for a war that seems to have no resolution and is going to require some kind of peace deal to end, because they're never going to just have a clear military victory. Whether you consider those valid, you know, they're legitimate debating points, I think, is if you hold those concerns. I know a lot of people are skeptical of them. You can talk about that. But those were some of the concerns. But I think the overriding problem that Johnson faced here was the U.S. border, right? A lot of Republicans saw this package as their only real leverage this year to get more border security measures at the U.S.-Mexico border. And they were determined. Johnson himself had said for months that we cannot pass more Ukraine aid without border security. Now, he caved on that in the end, and he put up a separate bill on border security that he knew would go nowhere, but he sort of put it up separately so it wouldn't interfere with this aid package while still trying to show his conference that he was making another effort at border security. I mean, but there was an adamant feeling among some of the House Republicans that they would not do this without more border security. This was their red line, and Johnson actually crossed it and let this go through without border security. So there was a built-up anger, too, in the Republican base over this.
Right. It's understandable that they would try to use this for leverage, use the Ukraine spending for leverage on border security. But remember, they tried it, and it didn't work. It worked, and they didn't accept the answer. There was a Senate Republican, Senate Democrat, White House package of border security that maybe it wasn't everything that a lot of House Republicans would like, but it was probably the best thing they were going to get. See, the problem here is that Johnson was realistic, and in the sense to think, hey, you know, we can only get so much. You know, we have to compromise when you're in a divided government with narrow majorities in both chambers. You have to compromise. And he tried, and then the House GOP, at the urging of former President Donald Trump, rejected that border compromise. So it just wasn't in the cards now. It had been tried and it failed. And so Johnson basically said, you know, we got to do it without border. And I think he was being more realistic about that. And as far as I know you're trying to be fair to the House Republican critics of Ukraine spending by mentioning their arguments, but I think their concerns about Ukraine aid. But I think factually you can poke a lot of holes in those arguments. There's no real evidence of corruption. Europeans are pulling their weight. And as far as what's the end game and what's the strategy, when have we ever had a war where we knew exactly how it was going to turn out? Right. This is a myth that we have conflicts where we say, you know, OK, here's how it's going to go and here's where it's going to end, etc. You know, you just fight, you give it your all. And then at the end of the day, there is always a negotiated settlement, but it's usually because one side has won militarily.
OK, well, you know, those parts are fair debating points, I think. You know, the other thing was, to a large extent, these Republican lawmakers, you can argue, were reflecting their constituents, which is what I was referring to earlier about the shifting politics over this on the Republican side. I think there was a CBS poll out the other day that had something like 61% of Republican voters oppose more Ukraine aid, right? So to a large extent, you can say they're simply reflecting their voters here that Republican voters have turned against this kind of foreign assistance.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a chicken and an egg thing. You know, a lot of the voters have turned against it because they're being, because there's a message that's going out, including from Republicans in Congress, about with some flawed arguments against the aid. And some Kremlin-inspired disinformation that's making the rounds, and a lot of people are believing it, like the yachts that I mentioned earlier. But yeah, there is definitely, you know, this strain of let's take care of ourselves first. But what has won the day, it looks like, is the point of view that says it is in our national interest to help one of our partners in Europe fight one of our principal adversaries without us having to shed our own blood before we have to do so for a minimal percentage of our defense budget.
The other thing at play here too, John, I think, is that if you looked at who was for the Ukraine aid and who was against, the more senior, more establishment-minded Republicans were the ones willing to back this, right? And you did have like House Foreign Affairs Chairman Mike McCaul, House Intelligence Chairman Mike Turner, the ones who have access to the more classified intelligence, the ones who have made the trips to Ukraine, maybe having a better understanding of what's at stake here for Europe, are the ones who vocally really backed this aid. And you had the newer members of Congress, I'm generalizing a little bit too much probably, but relatively newer, more rebellious members of Congress, certainly the Freedom Caucus folks, but broader, much broader than that, because it was a majority of the conference.
Right.
Who opposed the aid and I think were more reflective of their voters, where their voters are, or they think their voters are, the polls suggest voters are, in resisting more foreign aid right now.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the three Mikes, Mike Turner, Intelligence, Mike Rogers, Armed Services, and Mike McCall, Foreign Affairs, were very vocal and had a joint statement, I believe, about a week or 10 days ago, supporting this National Security Supplemental. And I would include Mike Johnson on that list. You know, Johnson himself, addressing reporters in Statuary Hall last week, cited the briefings that he has received on Ukraine as being influential in how he has turned around on the subject. You know, I mean, everyone wants to think that politicians only do things for purely, you know, electoral reasons, but sometimes they do things because they learn something that changes their mind or affects their decision making. And that may very well have been the case here, at least for Johnson. But yeah, there's definitely been that split in the party. And you are absolutely right to point out that it was not just the firebrand members of the GOP conference in the House that voted against Ukraine aid, but it included a substantial portion, in fact, the majority of the GOP members in the House.
Right. And the other interesting thing to me was that, you know, we did see this amendment from Kat Kamik of Florida, who proposed cutting all the economic aid to Ukraine, keeping the military aid, but cutting the economic aid. And among Republicans, her amendment won a whopping vote. I think there were only like 59 Republicans opposed to that one. Now, the amendment was defeated, we should say, because Democrats made sure they would kill it. But it does suggest that Republicans might have been more open to strictly military aid for Ukraine if the economic aid were eliminated. Can't know for sure, but it did suggest that there was a real concern over the economic portion of this package as opposed to just sending weapons to Ukraine among Republicans.
Right. That's absolutely true. And then there was another amendment by Ukrainian-born Representative Victoria Spartz, Republican of Indiana, who would have not only struck that economic aid, but she also would have prevented the president from drawing down billions of dollars of additional U.S. weapons stocks to send to Kyiv. Her amendment was defeated 105-319, and she didn't get quite as much Republican support for hers compared to Kamik's amendment. So that was also one of the ones that was on the agenda on Saturday in a similar vein. But you're right. This whole idea of economic aid or humanitarian aid is something that draws even more opposition, especially among Republicans.
Right. And I do think that also that curious to me, I'd love to know whether if he had stripped out the economic aid, whether more Republicans would have been on board with this. I mean, there was an attempt, right, to make that economic aid more palatable, which basically ironically came from Donald Trump, who floated this idea of making this aid a loan instead of an outright grant. And Johnson quickly seized on that idea and amended this thing so that part of this money would be a loan, although it's a forgivable loan. I mean, it raised questions whether there's much substance to it. I mean, there was no Ukraine doesn't necessarily have to pay it back anyway. Was it more symbolic? But it was an attempt, I think, by Johnson to make that economic aid more palatable by calling it a loan. Seems like that didn't work either, though, right? It didn't win over many more Republican votes, I don't think.
Right. It didn't win enough Republican votes, but it didn't matter in the end because there were enough Democratic votes combined with nearly half the Republican votes for the overall package. And the fact that Johnson got that provision in the underlying bill, and that is making the economic aid. Let's be clear: it's not all the aid; it's the minority of the aid in this package that goes to economic support.
Right.
Making that a forgivable loan, and so one important thing for Johnson was the fact that that was in there enabled him after the vote to go before reporters. And when he was asked the question, you know, why couldn't you have done this months ago? Or why couldn't you have just taken up the Senate's bill, which is also $95 billion and was practically the same as the House bill? That was one of the things he cited, was unlike the Senate's bill, this one has this loan instead of a grant for economic aid for Ukraine. He mentioned a couple of other things. You know, there's a provision in there that tries to ensure more accountability for the spending, and another one that requires the Pentagon to, or the administration to, describe its strategy in Ukraine. He noted that those were not in the Senate bill. But to me, those are kind of window dressing.
And one more thing I think he noted, which is important, is that there's a provision to seize frozen Russian assets that I think are worth about $5 billion that would presumably help pay for some of the Ukraine aid. That provision was brought into a separate bill that passed too.
Correct.
That was also designed to win over more Republican support because it means less taxpayer dollars going to Ukraine if they're able to seize these frozen Russian assets. These were all attempts by Johnson to make this package more politically palatable for his Republican base, who really felt uncomfortable with it. And as I say, he did get it over the finish line, but he did not win a majority of his majority. So it does hurt him that it's Democrats who really delivered the critical votes here.
Right.
And weakens his standing a little bit. He survives this, I think, but with a lot of anger now from the hardcore right. You know, the chief critic, Marjorie Taylor Greene, was on Fox on Sunday saying Mike Johnson has betrayed America. Those are her words. He's betrayed Republican voters. She said his speakership is over. She's calling on him to resign. Otherwise, she'll force her motion to vacate, which would require a floor vote on whether to oust him. She's been slow walking that thing. She's not ready to pull the trigger on it, it sounds like. But she's hanging it over his head big time in hopes that he'll resign. He's made clear he will not resign. I don't think there's any chance he will resign. But it shows how ugly the politics have gotten and how internally, how angry that Republican conference has become.
Yeah. But as I said earlier, I do not think that she will succeed in the motion to vacate vote if it comes up. And
right. Democrats have suggested they might be willing to save Johnson and actually
right.
vote.
And if Marjorie Taylor Greene sees the same thing that we're seeing, does she bother to bring it up for a vote if she knows she's going to fail? The answer may be yes, because she's about the performative aspect of politics. She's about showing, you know, that she's fighting for her constituents, and that's how she sees her role as fighting for her constituents. But the answer may be no if she thinks it would hurt her more politically to suffer a defeat on the floor on this. So it's going to be interesting to see how she and her fellow supporters of the motion to vacate idea go forward. And we may know soon.
Right. And we should say another point that the critics of this package raised that clearly they felt uncomfortable with was the roughly $9 billion in this package for humanitarian aid, which is really for humanitarian aid all over the globe, really. It wasn't specifically designated. But some of these critics said they fear that a lot of it would end up in the hands of Hamas, which governs the Gaza Strip and attacked Israel on October 7th. And they don't want to see anything that could go to Hamas. Now, the bill, I think, specifically prohibits any money going to Hamas.
Yes.
Or to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees that came under heavy fire because some of their members were accused of participating in the attack on Israel. So there are safeguards in the bill, but clearly some of the hardcore conservatives are uncomfortable also with humanitarian aid and still have concerns that those safeguards may not be adequate to that it could still benefit Hamas somehow, right?
Yep, they have those concerns. I don't know whether there's any validity to them because of the things that you just mentioned. And you know, we need to also note there's an incredible humanitarian catastrophe happening in Gaza right now, with tens of thousands or scores of thousands of people potentially facing starvation. And so that's the context of this. And it was a very small number of employees of the UNRWA, something like 13 out of scores of thousands of employees who were accused of being involved in the October 7th attacks. Just a couple notes for context.
Yeah. Speaking of which, John, I do want to touch on, we should note the Israel aid, right? There's like $26 billion here for Israel. And there had been some concern that a lot of Democrats would oppose Israel aid because of the Netanyahu government and their concerns about how Netanyahu is waging this war in Gaza, that he's gone too far. They don't want to send him any offensive weapons. In the end, the vote, though, on Israel was pretty lopsided, right? I think there were only 58 voting against, 366 in favor. So now the ones against, I think, were, I forget, almost all Democrats or all Democrats, you know, so it's still a sizable, but it wasn't some huge resistance to Israel aid, I would say. Fair?
Yeah, correct. It was 21 Republicans and 37 Democrats voted against the Israel.
So only 37 Democrats out of 213, whatever it is now, it keeps changing, but not exactly a size of, I mean, significant, but not a huge block of the Democrats ended up opposing Israel here.
Right. Not enough to matter. And this is, you know, another demonstration of the bipartisan support for Israel and for continuing to arm Israel, and no conditions set in here for the use of those weapons beyond what is in existing law, which critics say is not being enforced, about, you know, the humanitarian use of U.S. supplied weapons. The bill's got like $10 billion in it for developing or producing U.S. or Israeli made weapons, such as anti-missile and anti-rocket systems. It's also got money to replenish U.S. stocks that have been drawn down previously to help Israel. And it's got, I think, $2.4 billion in there to pay for U.S. military operations to date in the Middle East, which I hasten to add is a number that's going to go up before you know it. It's already way out of date. There's, you know, because they've done the humanitarian support in Gaza. They helped Israel defend itself against the Iranian attack. They've continued to fend off Houthi missile attacks in the Red Sea. And when I say they, I mean the U.S. military. So that price tag is going to go up, and we'll be seeing that come to Capitol Hill sometime soon. And one other note, speaking of money going to the U.S. military or to the U.S., I think we should point out that even though the Ukraine portion of this, for example, and the whole thing is called foreign aid, and the Ukraine piece was, the shorthand version is Ukraine aid. But in reality, most of the money is going to American contractors to build weapons to send to Ukraine, to build weapons to fill U.S. stocks that were drawn down to help Ukraine, or to pay back the Defense Department for what it's done to date to help Ukraine. So the money's mainly staying here in the United States.
But right, and that point was made ad nauseum by supporters of this package in hopes of winning more support.
Right.
Because it's not aid going really going overseas as so much as just sending the weapons overseas.
Yeah, but I don't think that was very well understood by the public, and especially when just the simple act of referring to the bill as Ukraine aid sort of denotes that just putting money on a ship and sending it over there to me. So it's just important to clarify that.
Yeah. Final point, John, is the timing of this. Now, the Senate has to take this package up again because it was changed, and they are supposed to do that as early as Tuesday. It could drag a day or two. You know, it could go to Wednesday. We're not sure yet. But I don't think there's any doubt the Senate will pass it because they passed a very similar package in February with about 70 yes votes. So it's clear it'll pass. They have some work to do, but it will pass. But, you know, it was striking to me on the same day that the House voted for this Ukraine aid, Russia was bombarding the Ukrainian port city of Odessa with a fresh round of missiles. The attacks have been relentless now for months. Ukraine is clearly on the defensive and weakening. It does beg the question, assuming this package finally passes this week, what then? How, you know, can these weapons even get there in time now to push Russian forces back? This doesn't happen overnight just because the bill is signed, right?
Correct. I mean, it's correct.
It takes a good long time before the thing, before weapons can start flowing and the transports can be arranged and all of that.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, by all accounts, the Ukrainians have suffered on the battlefield as a result of this, you know, months-long delay in getting this thing through the House and through now through Congress and onto the president's desk. So they have, it has hurt. Okay. As to when it can be available, apparently, reportedly, the Pentagon has a big package of weapons that it's set to announce pretty much as soon as this bill becomes law. But the only stuff that can go over right away is the stuff that comes from American stocks, and that can go immediately. But it takes time to build, or in some cases, even they're still developing some of the weapons. So that will take a long time. But again, what it does is it sends a signal to the world. And so Europeans, you know, we've seen in the last 2 years how when the United States makes a commitment of certain tanks or fighter jets or whatever, that European countries who had been kind of, they hadn't acted, once the United States acted, then the Europeans did. And so I think it will unlock a lot of things. And apparently some of the weapons that Ukrainians need right now on the battlefield are especially air defense weapons that the U.S. alone is capable of providing. Some of those will go right away. But again, some of it will take a while.
It's been an extraordinary week, and it's fascinating to see how this will play out here. But that's all the time we have for today. If you like what you heard here, you should subscribe to the CQ Budget newsletter, which hits your inbox every morning the Congress is in session. You can find that at CQ.com. You can find all of our budget coverage on Ukraine aid and much more at CQ.com or rollcall.com. My thanks again to John Donnelly for joining me. Thanks, John.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. I'm David Lerman, your budget tracker. We'll see you next time.